Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 23rd episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today, we continue our dissection of Act 3, Scene 2, with the play within the play. This next sequence, in fact, contains both the play within the play and the conversations held by the audience during its presentation. I wonder if it's at all how audiences behaved in Elizabethan times, or at least special presentations for the court. Hamlet's behavior is especially appalling and disrespectful to the players. Are noisy audiences supposed to see themselves in this mirror? The staging may reveal each director's opinion on the subject. It's not their only challenge, however. Though large parts of the play are often cut for time, it must still convincingly reveal the king's guilt. Directors and actors must juggle time and emotional impact, the player's drama and Hamlet's cruel comedy, and both the players and their audience to create an effective whole. No small order. Let's first look at the text itself and see what resonates. Staging unseen. The first exchange. From King Claudius, how fares our cousin Hamlet? And Hamlet answers, excellent in faith, of the chameleon's dish, I eat the air, promise crammed, you cannot feed capons. So, well, words well chosen. Hamlet eats of the chameleon's dish because he's in fact a chameleon, changing in this very scene from director to sincere friend to actor to madman before our very eyes. Then Hamlet teases Polonius about his college acting. The old man says, I did enact Julius Caesar. I was killed in the Capitol. Brutus killed me. And Hamlet, it was a brute part of him to kill so capital a calf there. It's an inside joke since Shakespeare himself has a play called Julius Caesar. It also presages Polonius' own stabbing. Hamlet jokes about Hamlet's brute part, much as he will later sincerely apologize to Laertes for killing his father, claiming that his madness was guilty, but he was not, divorcing the murderer from the brute part of himself that committed the murder. Then is the whole bit with Hamlet asking the jilted Ophelia if he can lie in her lap, insisting he didn't mean country matters. My pocket edition, obviously, meant for the classroom, because it omits this lascivious exchange. The exchange between them continues, and Ophelia corrects him on how long his father's been dead, to which Hamlet answers, oh heavens, die 2 months ago and not forgotten yet. Then there's hope a great man's memory may outlive his life half a year. But, by your lady, he must build churches then, or else shall he suffer not thinking on with the hobby horse, whose epitaph is, for oh, the hobby horse is forgot. The hobby horse was a traditional pantomime in which two men dressed as a horse danced to a tune, then died a magical death and rose again when the music changed. As a metaphor for the revenant Hamlet Sr., it's appropriate. As it is for the context of the dumb show we're about to see, the contraction of time, out of joint as it is of course a theme that repeats throughout the play. And we should wonder, if all the details of the murder are in the dumb show, why Claudius doesn't react right then and there. Directors may stage the scene so that he isn't paying attention in this moment, but that's hardly satisfying. What the text seems to indicate is that the dialogue of the mousetrap is an important component in making Claudius relate the play's events to those of his own life, or else that his conscience is caught less by the play's incidents than by Hamlet's rather clear accusation at the end of it. Ophelia has questions like, will he, that is the prologue, will he tell us what this show meant? And Hamlet, I or any show that you'll show him, but not you ashamed to show. He'll not shame to tell you what it means. To which Ophelia responds, you are not, I'll mark the play. Here, Hamlet accuses Ophelia of herself putting on a show, that her love was false, etc., though at the same time intimating that she's a whore unashamed to expose herself. Her retort sounds like a pun on naughty and not, to me. She returns the insult of being nothing by signifying his words are meaningless, or that she refuses to acknowledge their meaning. As the prologue starts, we find that whereas Shakespeare's worlds already take place in a heightened poetic reality, he gives the play within the play some extra height by making the verses rhyme. The first scene is all about the player king telling his queen that if he dies, she should remarry. And she says she can't and won't because she loves him too much. Whether or not this is part of Hamlet's addition to the murder of Gonzago, and the player queen's lines that follow almost assuredly are, she goes, "Oh, confound the rest. Such love must need be treason in my breast. In second husband, let me be accursed. None wed the second but who killed the first." It draws an idealized picture of his parents' marriage and of the country of Denmark, this fair world, as it's called here. In the play, family and national environments are the same, and we get a glimpse of how things were before Hamlet Sr.'s murder, though from a biased point of view. Hamlet calls the queen's lines wormwood. Now, wormwood has a double meaning we can almost certainly be sure is exploited by Shakespeare. On the one hand, it is a plant with emetic properties, and he's trying to use the words to force Claudius to vomit up his guilt. Wormwood is also the name of a star from the Book of Revelations related to the apocalypse, which Hamlet might invoke as a pun, his frequent idiom, here a metaphor for the end of his journey, the end of Claudius's kingship, and the coming end of all their lives. Either way, it supports the notion that these lines, in particular, were inserted by the prince. The player king, "I do believe you think what now you speak, but what we do determine oft we break." Compare this line to Claudius's wick or snuff when he tries to ascertain if Laertes really has it in him to kill Hamlet, even once he's cooled off. The speech continues with several stylistic figures creating mirror effects in the play's text. Grief joys, joy grieves, and whether love lead fortune or else fortune love, for example. Thematically, these support the idea that the play itself is a mirror of the court. The rhyming scheme may also be part of that effect. As we know, the player queen restates her refusal to remarry, and as the scene ends, Hamlet asks his mother if she likes the play. Famously, she answers, "The lady protests too much, methinks." In other words, Gertrude did not protest this much, and sees the performance as a flawed mirror of her own life. Consequently, her own guilt for betraying a dead husband is not revealed. She does not see herself in this. The promise made by the player queen is the fruit of Hamlet's imagination, and Gertrude was never bound by it. It can also be played like she's being defensive, especially given Hamlet's other public comments about the hastiness of her marriage. Claudius asks if there's any offense in it, and Hamlet says it's all jest, reveals also the title of the play, The Mousetrap, and then spoils what happens next, the poisoning in the ear and everything. He seems to give the game away, basically telling Claudius to confess if his soul be not free, the line about having free souls so it judges us not, or rather, not to confess if he doesn't want to get caught. Note also that the murder on stage is the image of a real murder in Vienna. Hamlet is skirting the truth. The play is actually based on two true crime stories. Hamlet keeps narrating and slinging more insults at Ophelia, and she says, "You are keen, my lord, you are keen." And Hamlet, "It would cost your groaning to take off my edge." Another pair of lines, censored in my pocket edition. The violent image of Hamlet's erection as a sword may prove fodder for some critics when we get to the sword fight between Hamlet and Laertes. Have at it, guys. The second player starts his bit, with Hamlet still talking over him, and as the details of the murder are given, Claudius is indeed bothered. The play is interrupted by the king's exclamation, but it's up to each director and actor to decide what makes him rise, ask for light, and leave. Is it his conscience playing a trick on him despite Hamlet's obvious goading? The light is for the darkness in his soul. Certainly, he would be surprised that Hamlet knew such specific details as the ear poison. Or he might be outraged at the inferred accusation in open court and want to remove himself from Hamlet's scandalous spectacle. The interpretation may differ from adaptation to adaptation, as we'll see. In Branagh's 1996 adaptation, we enter the scene on a kiss between Claudius and Gertrude before the camera pans down to the stage, even as a chandelier rises and the audience applauds. It doesn't applaud in the stage's direction, however, but in the royal couple's. What is actually the show here? Even to the audience within the film, Hamlet's play is probably less important than the courtly soap opera of the couple so quickly nuptialed after the death of the old king and the mad ravings of the prince. Like Horatio, they'll be watching Claudius and Gertrude. In fact, Branna cuts to Horatio and to the gossiping court often, reminding us of this public scrutiny. When Hamlet appears on stage, a spotlight is immediately lit. He is the country's beloved prince, as Claudius mentions elsewhere in the context of not being able to easily dispose of him. And the audience laughs at all his jokes, at least until they become too cruel. Claudius's voice is strained when addressing Hamlet, while Gertrude is happy to see him in good spirits. It seems likely Claudius has not shared what he heard Hamlet say in the previous act. Ophelia, for her part, seems quietly sad, even embarrassed. She was no doubt the object of gossip even before this night, and Hamlet's public cruelties would make this a very difficult evening to bear. And then there's Polonius, who grits his teeth and takes Hamlet's humiliating him by dragging him on stage. Here, Branna shows how the audience's reactions can influence our understanding of the play. The way people roll their eyes and smile when Polonius says he once played Julius Caesar. You can tell it resonates with them. The king's chief courtier playing an emperor? Perfect casting for someone the court probably sees as a brown-nosing opportunist with too elevated ambitions. As Hamlet plonks himself down next to Ophelia, he mocks her and his mother openly, shouting his lines so that everyone can hear, letting his rising anger drive the scene.
Lady, shall I lie in your lap?
No, my lord.
I mean my head upon your lap.
Aye, my lord.
What do you think I meant, country matters?
I think nothing, my lord.
It's a fair thought to lie between maid's legs.
What is, my lord?
No thing.
You're merry, my lord.
Who, I? Oh, God, you're only jig-maker. What should a man do but be merry? For look you, how cheerfully my mother looks, and my father died within 2 hours.
The court actively ignores him, though he does set them on to whispering. Hamlet even manages to make his mother blush at the shortness of her grieving period. Though Claudius may be guilty of murder, Gertrude is guilty of not loving her first husband enough, and she is just as caught in the mousetrap. Branna continues to mix up the play on stage and the play in the audience, having these early mockeries end on applause. It sounds like they're applauding Hamlet's bit, but they're really cheering for the players who have just come on stage. Eventually, Hamlet will be on stage too, and it won't matter what's part of the play and isn't. Hamlet's mischief gives way to the dumb shows, which is played so broadly and quickly that it doesn't give away the play's plot. That's the advantage with doing the whole play. Many versions will use the dumb show and nothing else to save time. Here, it allows for a more mysterious dumb show. Ophelia doesn't seem stupid for asking whether the show contains the argument of the play, just as it's reasonable for Claudius not to see the image of his murder in the action as yet. The players' costumes set the play in the Middle Ages, contrasting well with the more Napoleonic look of the film's events, while winking at the period in which Hamlet is actually set. The players give an intimate and very emotional performance, in keeping with Hamlet's instructions and the first player's qualities in his earlier monologue. It's powerful stuff that should connect with the royals. But Hamlet is anxious because the king and queen aren't always watching the play, instead feeding each other bits of Turkish delight, kissing or drinking, and we're often reminded that that is Claudius's vice. Will Hamlet miss his chance to show the king's guilt? It helps explain why he later jumps on stage to draw their attention. When they do watch the play, they empathize with the wrong things. The love between the player king and the player queen, for example, makes Claudius and Gertrude get closer and publicly cuddle. Their reaction tells us they really are in love, no matter what has happened before. At the mention of the second husband, however, oh, the court starts looking back at them. The play is suddenly quite scandalous, and the royals' point of view heightens the paranoia. The player king is so kind and loving and idealized Hamlet Sr. that he gives the player queen permission to wed again, but it's her who swears she won't. It's in moments like these that Hamlet seems more intent to show his mother as unfaithful than his stepfather as a murderer. Or perhaps it's a feint, letting the court and the king think he's going after his mother to hit them with a surprising revelation about Claudius himself. In the play, the player queen does not betray the player king, she betrays herself. Is this at cross purposes with Hamlet's intent and opinion? Or is betraying oneself worse than betraying others? Let's not forget the theme of the play can be found in the line, "To thine own self be true." Hamlet's true self is not a murderer-avenger, which is what delays the action of the play and causes the tragedy. Here, he accuses Gertrude of not being true to herself, or to the image he has of her, the wife of his father. And during all this, Ophelia seems quite taken by the play. Again, Branna makes a lot of inferences through reaction shots. Is Ophelia seeing there the image of the relationship she wishes she had with Hamlet? Does she idealize, perhaps, the unseen relationship between her father and dead mother? Polonius may well tell his stories of suffering much for love around the house. And as the scene runs its course, Hamlet slowly creeps down to the stage. He gets the royals' reaction to the play and starts to act as the chorus. In another cruel exchange with Ophelia, he plays on her better worse remark, linking it to wedding vows, for better or for worse.
You are keen, my lord, you are keen.
It will cost you a groaning to take off mine edge.
Still better and worse.
Oh, so you mistake your husband's.
Does Branna's pronunciation create an additional layer of pun? The line is, "So you must take your husband's," but I hear, "So you mistake your husband's." It's a potential dig at his mother's swinging allegiances. Savage with his own potential wife and with his parents, Hamlet, by osmosis, is the same with the player murderer on stage, an image of his stepfather. The accusation is not so much in the play as it is in Hamlet staring up at Claudius from the stage. It is implicit, verging on explicit, and people start to squirm in their seats. Slow zoom on Hamlet and the king as the editor cuts in with scenes from Hamlet Sr.'s murder. Are we seeing Hamlet's imagination, or is it Claudius's memory? The edit seems to suggest the latter. If the king is moved to stand, it is likely not because the play holds a mirror up to his own actions, but rather that Hamlet seems to know what happened. Claudius shows restraint, however.
Give me some light. Away.
Give me some light and his bitter away are said in a low, menacing voice that communicates that he has been insulted, but not that he's been rumbled. The court leaves in a hurry, probably fearing for their lives. If the king catches them with the wrong expression, they're in trouble. Will the events of this evening spread like wildfire and cause the almost revolution during which the rabble at the gates proclaim Laertes king? Quite possibly. Gertrude's reaction is of interest as well. She keeps her eyes on Claudius all the way through. In anger? In outrage? Hard to say. Later, she blames Hamlet for offending the king. But in this moment, maybe she wonders if it's all true, and if the man she loves today killed the man she loved the day before. Ophelia holds her head even closer to a breakdown. Her story is one of disillusionment, of a young girl who probably saw the best in everyone, finding out reality is a much more cynical and corrupt place. In the Olivier version, trumpets sound. Everyone enters while Hamlet is in the dark center. First, courtiers and players showing deference, and only then do the royals come down the stairs. Hamlet goes up to help his mother come down. Is he lulling her into a false sense of security? That would be coherent with the whole idea of putting on a show, the play, and his high spirits. His first shot at her, choosing to sit by Ophelia instead of her, seems even more mercurial from her point of view, and calculated cruelty from ours.
Come hither, my dear Hamlet, sit by me.
No good, mother. Here's metal more attractive.
The courtiers gasp at the sight. The idea that this sequence scandalously upends Denmark's hierarchy is something today's audiences might not at first get. Not that Ophelia is kindly treated. Hamlet grabs her by the wrist and pushes her down into a chair. Though this is a violent gesture, her father Polonius is rather pleased that it seems to confirm his still-held theory. The poor man is completely oblivious in this version, one of the few to laugh when Hamlet publicly humiliates him. Ophelia's own humiliation in this scene is more private. Gertrude and Claudius don't even hear Hamlet's loud accusations before the play starts. So it's as if we were watching it as a play. The actors are projecting their voices, but intimacy is nevertheless retained. This Ophelia is an innocent, naive girl, so the references to her lap do shock her here. Of the mousetrap, only the prologue and mime show are in the film. The prologue seems almost embarrassed at how short his text is, though he may just be intimidated by the royal audience. Did Hamlet write this? Since there's no dialogue, Where are the lines he inserted? If he did write the prologue, we might believe he set himself up for his "as woman's love" line. The mischief is definitely Hamlet's. On stage, the orchard is represented by a sickly-looking cactus-like tree, and the camera stays mobile as if to show a shared point of view. With no words spoken, we're allowed to focus on the audience's reactions. Ophelia catches Hamlet looking at the king, Horatio is also looking in that direction, and there is something to look at. Even Polonius notices the king having difficulty, though he assumes Claudius is taken ill. The play continues regardless, with the player queen finding her dead husband and being comforted by the murderer. There's a lot of gossip in the crowd, but it looks strange without Hamlet's more public accusations, as is the fact that the king is moved in such a fashion.
Give me some light!
Though he melodramatically asks for light, he acts as if blinded by the images in his mind. Hamlet brings a torch much too close to his face, and he flinches and runs off. Olivier follows this up with utter chaos. The queen looks at Hamlet with a "what have you done" kind of look, while everyone else runs in every possible direction, as in a scene from a monster movie. The natural order has been completely destroyed. As the king loses all control, so does the populace. And though Olivier doesn't explore every aspect of that idea, in the text, it does thematically lead to, first, the peasants proclaiming Laertes potential king, and second, the invasion of Denmark by Norway. In a sense, Olivier covers the cut of those plot elements with this scene, which does something similar through visuals. BBC 1980, Jacoby's Hamlet begins the scene in a cloak and skull mask, which makes Claudius laugh and Gertrude smile. The staging, in which Claudius immediately recognizes Hamlet under the mask, is ironic. What Claudius actually recognizes is that Hamlet will be the death of him. In fact, everyone who interacts with Hamlet as death will be dead by the end of the play. Hamlet's initial interaction with Ophelia shocks and grieves her, so he corrects his intent and puts the shame on her, acting disgusted that she thought of country matters.
Lady, shall I lie in your lap?
No, my lord.
I mean my head upon your lap.
Aye, my lord.
Did you think I meant country matters?
I think nothing, my lord.
To him, because of her recent betrayal, or possibly simply because of her gender, she is a whore and a deviant. He reiterates the idea when he says woman's love is brief, pointing it at her rather than his mother. Is there a difference in his mind, or does he paint all women with the same brush? The mousetrap is well realized through stagecraft that creates an optical illusion of depth in the set, and a lot of time is spent on the mime show. As it plays out, the clown versions of the king, queen, and murderer make the real king, queen, and murderer laugh. Hamlet acts like he's evaluating the events the play is based on for the first time, but also seems disturbed at how much fun Claudius is having with it. The king doesn't clue in that the murder is an image of the one he's committed, and he roars with laughter. The mime show ends with the murderer quelling the player queen's grief with a rich gift of jewels. She's essentially being bought, another reference to her being a whore in Hamlet's eyes. The play itself appears in slightly abridged form, but nothing major is lost, and it moves along quite nicely. It's only at Wormwood that Hamlet finally attracts the attention of the royals. All previous accusations were made in Ophelia's confidence alone, and it's perhaps only then that the king and queen realize the play might be about them. Up to that point, they were fresh teenagers on a date, but now they are more silent and squirming. After the first scene, Gertrude is so caught up in her own thoughts, she almost forgets to applaud, and only does so awkwardly, with too much enthusiasm. She's the one who protests too much. Hamlet puts the accent on her in "she'll keep her word," a veiled accusation, and by this point, though Claudius is far less easy to read, he's lost all his cheer. With the player king confused by Hamlet's interruption and attempt to spoil the play's ending, the prince waves the murderer on stage. Jacoby shows Hamlet's impatience quite well here, losing his temper when the player doesn't immediately start speaking the lines.
This is one Lucianus, nephew to the king. Begin, murderer. Pucks, leave your damnable faces and begin!
And finally, Hamlet loses it altogether, in a rush to see Claudius's reaction, interjecting just as the player king is poisoned and racked with pain. He makes sure to mention the garden, so that no detail of the accusation is lost. He over-eggs the pudding. This adaptation makes us realize that though the play is designed to catch the conscience of the king, Hamlet never lets it do that. He wants to rumble Claudius himself. And does he succeed? From the staging, it's really not clear he does. It's not even clear the king is guilty of the crime he's accused of. Though Hamlet accuses Claudius of being frighted, the king's reaction is really to stand and approach Hamlet, bringing a torch too close to his eyes. It's a standoff. He asked for light not because he struggled with his own darkness, but because he wanted to expose Hamlet's. Violence almost breaks out before the king catches himself. Hamlet starts to giggle insanely, giving Claudius the chance he needs to turn around and smile at the assembly. He sends everyone home, and it's understood that the evening's diversion has been just another of Mad Hamlet's shenanigans. We're left wondering if anyone really did catch the king's conscience, or even if there was anything to catch in the first place. Now, despite his adaptation's many cuts, Zeffirelli acknowledges this scene's importance by not only showing a good part of the play within a play, as written, but by collapsing parts of various other scenes into it. For example, Polonius is here, part of the show. He gives a cue to the musicians and introduces the players on stage with the pastoral historical speech from Act 2, Scene 2. He makes a meal of it, too, enjoying the laughter he gets from the audience, sincere in his praise, but also exaggerating to get a reaction.
These are the best actors in the world! Either for tragedy, comedy, history, pastoral comical, historical pastoral, tragical historical, tragical comical historical pastoral, for the law of writ and the liberty. These are the only men!
Hamlet then has good reason to ask about Polonius's university days, coming around with a cup of wine and an inebriated step. Claudius, already in high spirits, laughs at Hamlet's Brutus pun, which is ironic given that, like Julius Caesar, he'll be murdered by an adopted son. I'm surprised I actually never saw that connection before, but he's puzzled by the promise crammed comment. He's still trying to figure Hamlet out. Ophelia is at once impatient and hurt by Hamlet's words and actions, rolling wet eyes at the ceiling. It's a small moment, but one of Bonham Carter's best. Before the play, we're offered acrobats, clowns, and jugglers, during which time Hamlet and Ophelia have part of the nunnery scene. As already described in a previous episode, Zeffirelli is also a juggler. A juggler of scenes. It's their one private moment in the scene, as otherwise, Hamlet lets the king and queen overhear things just to make them squirm, treating them as if they weren't there. In fact, during the play, Ophelia is mostly forgotten, and some of her lines are given to others. The queen says of the prologue, "'Tis brief, my son," so Hamlet can direct his barbs straight at her. Later, Claudius gets, "'You are as good as a chorus, cousin,' as the director wants this to be a duel between the two men. After the prologue, playing it big and clownish because Hamlet never instructs the players in this version, the play starts without the dumb show and cut down to essential lines. The important lines are intact, but this collapse does hammer the point home pretty aggressively, giving Gertrude, all forced smiles and gritted teeth, reason to opine that the lady doth protest too much. The royals immediately feel targeted, and a satisfied Hamlet grins eagerly at their reaction. His plan is working, and he can't help but participate by mouthing words that he apparently wrote, or talking out of turn, mischievously pushing a patron back so he can slip the king a comment or two. Claudius can't be sure Hamlet knows the truth, and the way he pitches his question about whether or not he knows the argument, you can tell he finds it strange Hamlet already knows the story. By this point, Claudius is avoiding Hamlet's gaze, sweating, gulping down wine nervously. This Hamlet may be hyperactive, but he doesn't shout his less-than-veiled accusation at the whole assembly. He takes the royals into his confidence in a hushed voice, manically pulling at threads on his clothes as the story and Claudius's composure unravel. He doesn't tell Gonzago what to do, though that player does lose his lines and simply enacts the murder, which is an echo of the dumb show. We instead focus, as Hamlet does, on Claudius's reaction. At first he leans in, then rises, holds his head in pain, and drops his cup, On stage, the player king has dropped down hard enough to dislodge his crown, which is a nice piece of stagecraft. And it's a mirror to Claudius' own loss of control. Hamlet steps all over the audience to follow the advancing Claudius, fixed on his expression. Claudius points at the murderer, who looks positively dumbstruck, then begins to laugh insanely, turning towards the audience. No one seems to know how to take this, least of all the players, and he runs out of the castle to get some air. Chaos in his wake. The verdict definitely points to guilty. Hamlet 2000 features some important cuts, including the entirety of the play within the play, replaced by a dialogueless art film of Hamlet's creation. While it serves the same function as the play, by showing images designed to perturb the king and queen, it does mean a lot of commentary on the play had to be cut as well. "'Tis brief, does protest too much, is there no offense," for example. Still, staging the scene in a movie theater does have its uses. There's a depth to such a room that allows the entire audience to be seen at different levels in the same shot. And the director keeps the royals in the background, kissing, until Claudius eventually speaks. Hamlet's words are for Ophelia alone, keeping up the barrage of insults that started in their previous scene together, playful but highly sardonic. What comes across is that Ophelia really doesn't understand him. Everything she says in this section is wrong, either a misunderstanding or really Hamlet switching codes on her. Hamlet seems angry with her for not understanding him, though it's also his fault for behaving so erratically. Only at the end of his diatribe about people forgetting his father does he raise his voice enough for Claudius to notice him and ask, "How fares my cousin Hamlet?" The answer is cut down to a simple "excellent" after a pregnant pause that dismisses the king and lets it be known he really has nothing to say to his stepfather. Polonius, meanwhile, is absent from this scene entirely, and after all, there's no reason for him to have the Brutus lines, seeing as there are no players or talk of acting. The film starts with white-on-red title cards, with Hamlet's or the play's own title, The Mousetrap, A Tragedy by Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. Kind of sounds like Shakespeare's play. A visual reminder, perhaps, of his aborted rise to the throne. The images shown include time-lapse photography, clips from old movies, and Monty Python-style animation. In order, we see a flower opening, clips of a happy childhood with a father and his son, the world turning, a bottle of poison, animation showing the poison going into the ear, scenes of murder and death, athletes falling like dominoes, the flower wilting, a child comes down the stairs, Mark Antony and Cleopatra, a reference to another adulterous relationship in Shakespeare, some pornographic material, a crowd applauding, and a king crowning himself before the mirror. At the sight of the poison, Claudia starts to sweat, catching the obvious accusation. For Gertrude, the difficult part of the film is the pornography, and given her innate lasciviousness, it must be because she gets the inference. She is the pornographic Cleopatra on the screen, and it's her son who has represented her in this way. Remember, there are no other authors of this drama, no Murder of Gonzago template. Claudius will walk out of the theater at the end, fighting with his demons, while Gertrude attempts to follow, speechless, as she turns towards her son. By virtue of the many cuts, this Hamlet is less active than Shakespeare's, but he needs to prod the king and queen much less, because he made the film, whereas in the text, The Mousetrap is meant to be a play he ordered from the player's repertoire. The message is more direct, and Hamlet need not jump on stage to make his intent clear. The Mousetrap is translated into a German experimental film in Fodor's vision. It must have been made very quickly, although the play does allow for temporal anomalies like this, as we've often discussed. In the film, we first see a hammer and a screwdriver, the murder weapons, as it turns out. Then the murderer thinking, plotting, the queen getting her picture taken, an image of the people's adulation. At this point, we cut to Hamlet in the audience, nodding along. Even in the text as written, the queen hammers her point home a bit stridently. Gertrude's evaluation isn't far off. So this might indicate that her dialogue was manipulated by Hamlet. A similar idea is used here to get Gertrude as well as Claudius. In the text, it makes her an oathbreaker. In this version's film, she is a co-conspirator whose motivation seems to be greater fame and power. Okay, the film continues. The queen is having dinner and flirting insincerely with the king. In the audience, there are uncomfortable shots of Claudius and Polonia. In this version, his new mistress, right? Does she see herself on screen? Is she actually the queen character who seduces the king to slip him poison? We assume it's to play her queen because that's what's in the text, but Fodor's gender switching game may give a different interpretation. On screen, drinks are brought to the table, and in the audience, it sparks Ophelia's "You are Mary." But as with most of the dialogue that should undercut the mousetrap, it's done in voiceover, making it very ambiguous as to when these words were actually spoken. Usually, we can assume they were said before the start of the film. In others, such as Gertrude's "The Lady Doth Protest Too Much," that wouldn't make sense. Are these words just the imaginings of Hamlet, memories of some kind? Or, since we never see the protest, are we hearing something said in an earlier part of the projection? Back in the film, the king drinks and topples over. Polonia and Claudius share a look, and again, we wonder if she's the woman. Horribly, the poison is just a knockout drug, and the murderer must stab the king in the ear, driving the screwdriver down with his hammer. At first stab, we hear a horse neighing, perhaps an image imposed by Hamlet to represent his noble father. Claudius starts getting hot under the collar, and at the murder, Fodor flash cuts to every character's reaction. Shock is registered on almost all faces, even on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's, though one of them soon starts to laugh at how cool the violence is, like the sociopath he is. Children's laughter is heard on the soundtrack at this point. The king rises and, distraught, goes to stand before everyone, the movie projection flickering on his face. He's lost it completely, and he stands revealed. The projection is putting the murder on him, like blood on his hands. Everyone then leaves behind him, and only a judgmental Gertrude stays a moment to give her son a stern look, setting up the next scene, before leaving Hamlet and the smiling Horatio alone in the dark to enjoy their victory. Tennant's Hamlet is a petulant and mischievous child in this scene. The audience's entrance is scored with the Danish national anthem, as a barefoot Hamlet insolently whistles along. They ignore him, and we get the sense that his parents are already tired of his shenanigans. They do not appear to be particularly excited at the prospect of a night at the theater with him, and indeed, the audience is rather small. This is an intimate affair, not the public ones that other versions have created. We're definitely in the wake of Hamlet's attack on Ophelia. She comes in with her head down. Her father looks ever so puzzled. No one trusts Hamlet's mood. As if to give them reason, his giddy idleness is immediately disrespectful, throwing in an army salute with the chameleon's dish line, mocking the normal obedience one should show a father or a king. In the early part of the scene, everything is more intimate. Hamlet asks Polonius about his acting days in private conversation, and only Polonius laughs at the prince's pun. It's interesting, however, to see Polonius so confounded by the fact that he had to be killed in the play, which is a precursor to his actual senseless death in this play.
I did enact Julius Caesar. I was killed at the Capitol.
Hamlet runs off with Ophelia, grabbing her out of her seat to a position from where he can better observe the royals. At this, Polonius breaks the fourth wall to ask us if we marked that. Again, the scene's intimacy prevents him from being more public with his thoughts. Hamlet drags Ophelia down to the floor and wraps her arms around himself, mockingly bites her arm. It's a parody of a normal romantic relationship, and in a sense, perhaps a disguise. Sitting across from his parents, he appears to be getting back together with his girlfriend, but his cruel, unheard words tell another story. Tennant underlines the dirty pun in Country Matters.
Do you think I'm a cunt, Country Matters?
To make it harsh indeed. And yet, his "a woman's love" later is a private statement, sounding more sorry than mean.
It is brief, my lord.
As woman's love.
These private moments contrast with the one when Hamlet actually flings an accusation his parents' way, as he shows more and more difficulty reining himself in. At the jig-maker line, he gets up and dances humorously on the rug that will serve as a stage, making his mother laugh, which is the moment he chooses to begin his open cruelties. His very bitter delivery of "die 2 months ago and not forgotten yet" gives it a strong, ironic bent.
Oh, heavens! Die 2 months ago and not forgotten yet!
For Hamlet, 2 months is no more appropriate than 2 hours, and recalls the Hamlet from earlier in the play who was told to stop grieving. As the dumb show starts, Hamlet takes out his camera and starts filming it, or really, the royals' reactions to it. In this way, the film keeps the energy up by layering in Hamlet's point of view. We see when he chooses to look at his mother or stepfather, on what words, to catch what gestures. The dumb show is a most depraved affair, perhaps meant to shock more than amuse. A tiny king with giant ears comes out of a bald, fat queen's skirts and speaks unintelligibly. I was reminded of Pingu, honestly. Until he's poisoned by a glam murderer with a heart over his crotch, which, when removed, reveals an uncoiled slinky. The dead king's shroud becomes a ghostly sheet that runs off to let them have sex. Through this ridiculous piece of bawdry, Claudius laughs, not at all, holding his temper in check. We do see his reaction to the mock poisoning, which makes this Claudius quite aware of the insinuation from early on. He stews in his own guilt longer as a result. The play itself features rather extreme Elizabethan costumes and a staging that mirrors that of the royals, king left, queen right. Gertrude is bitter and impatient at the text. She knows very well what she's being accused of and finds it insulting. With great poise, she questions whether the player queen protests too much and gets a laugh from the audience. It's a show of power against Hamlet, and the audience seems to be on the queen's side in this. As for Claudius, the cracks start to show. Silent up to this point, he asks if there's offense in it, in fact proposing that there is, at which Polonius makes an odd gesture as if to stop him from speaking out. Have they decided prior to the play to just let Hamlet have his fun and show no reaction? Reacting, even with a smaller audience, is dangerous at this point because Hamlet is filming them. The mousetrap is theirs to get caught in. After mouthing many of the lines himself, it's time for the murder, and Hamlet can't help but get up and spoil the ending, just to force the reaction he's looking for. Triumphant, even as he ruins his own device. So does he succeed? The king rises, but walks calmly to a stagehand and requests light. He then brings the lantern over and shines it on Hamlet, as if revealing the prince's madness for all to see. He shakes his head, as if to say, "You won't get me so easily." And to the assembly, this may instead mean that he pities and softly chides Hamlet. But we know better, and the slightest of smiles from Patrick Stewart speaks volumes. That Hamlet thinks he's found a chink in the king's armor may be wishful thinking on his part, however. While I think Stewart gives very different performances as Claudius in this and the BBC version 29 years earlier, this is one scene where the two Claudiuses converge.
Lady, shall I lie in your lap?
No, my lord.
I mean my head upon your lap.
Aye, my lord.
Do you think I meant country matters?
I think nothing, my lord.
'Tis a fair thought indeed to lie between maids' legs.
The very brief part of this scene used in Slings and Arrows amounts to Hamlet's opening insults to Ophelia, but there are still lessons to be gleaned from it. On staging, Ophelia and Hamlet are sitting or crouching near the ground, which fits the lowbrow humor of the country matters line. Hamlet is in full madcap mode, rubbing his hands with devilish glee as Ophelia is continually hurt. Hamlet turns to the audience to say that's a fair thought to lie between maids' legs and gets a laugh without the need for Ophelia's question. Now, the audience gets it because the punchline precedes the joke. In the text, the fact that Ophelia asks for the joke to be explained isn't strictly necessary, though it does inform her traumatized character and works within the rhythm of the scene. By making Hamlet's line an aside, Ophelia does not have to react to it, and she comes off as even more deeply wounded. She's unable to properly interact with him. An aside that elicits a laugh, at this point, makes the audience complicit in Hamlet's cruelty. Because he shares his lewd thought with us, we empathize with him, which makes us his accomplices. Subtle, but subversive stuff.
Madam, how like you this play?
The lady doth protest too much, methinks.
Oh, but she'll keep her word.
Have you heard the argument? Is there no offense in it?
No, they do but jest, poison in jest. No offense in the word.
What do you call the play?
A mousetrap.
It's likely that if a Midwinter's Tales version of Hamlet were to actually be staged in full, it would be exhausting for both audience and actors, because it's presented as a quick-paced montage, so its energy level is consequently very high. It drives the montage well, however. Maloney's Hamlet is always moving around with a barely contained fury. Every line is an attack that justifies a more defensive tone from the royals. This short sequence takes us from "Madam, how like you display" to "The Mousetrap," the latter spoken in the direction of the audience, played as an important reveal. In the montage, it plays the role of the play's the thing, and shows us how those early scenes with the players could be removed from a particular staging, hiding from the audience Hamlet's true purpose until Act 3, Scene 2. Let's talk about the Classics Illustrated adaptations. Surprisingly, the old Boys Adventure Comics original version includes both the dumb show and the speaking play, though it makes huge cuts through the use of captions to fit them in. In other words, they both happen, but are not necessarily seen. The pantomime that precedes the play is visual, of course, so it becomes the backbone of the comics version. There are a number of interesting touches, as if the artist, freed from the Classics Illustrated constraint of heavy word balloons, has finally been allowed to show his quality. As the player queen leaves the sleeping king, for example, there's an odd expression on her face. Is she worried she might wake him, or is she colluding with the murderer and already feeling guilty? I also like the purely graphic juxtaposition of crown and poison, separating the two bottom panels of the page, showing how one can act as a gateway to the other. And the sequence continues on the next page, where the queen is offered jewels, which she seems to refuse according to her body language. So it's not always clear what she's thinking. That's Gertrude all over. A puzzled Ophelia asks about the argument of the play, the only live commentary made in this heavily edited version, but Hamlet leaves it to the prologue. There's no cruelty towards Ophelia or the royals, so the play is the only possible impetus for Claudius to lose it. Hamlet's antics do not play a part, or muddy the waters in any way. On purpose, perhaps, the player queen is a dead ringer for Ophelia, who's wearing the same kinds of clothes as well. After a few words from the prologue, the action cuts to Claudius's fit. We've seen the play's action through the pantomime, and we know the story because it's a mirror of Hamlet Sr.'s murder, so it's quite economical, while also respecting the events of Shakespeare's play. Needlessly, perhaps? If Claudius had reacted to the dumb show, it would have made more sense structurally. As is, even though we know everything, there still seems to be a scene missing. It makes you want to see the king's trigger. In the Berkeley version, Hamlet is likewise more pleasant to Ophelia, his smiles turning cruelties into something more like teasing. Tom Mandrake's art makes good use of shadows throughout the sequence, often keeping the royals hidden, even when they speak. The darkness of their sins and their ambiguity justify it. But it is starting to feel like they are shadows, ciphers, or otherwise non-characters. Even the "protest too much" line is given to Ophelia instead of Gertrude. One place where shadows are better used is in Hamlet's face. The darkness of Ophelia's lap plays across it when he turns more serious and thinks of his father, ironically, while entering a motherly womb. Mandrake does away with the dumb show in favor of the spoken play, his painted players in various cultural costumes, separating the heightened reality of the mousetrap with the medieval trappings of the play outside the play. In the absence of a preceding panto, Claudius now sees the accusation for the first time and reacts. Again, there are few public antics from Hamlet, so his idleness is not what distracts or affects the king. Both comics versions have chosen to make the king unambiguously guilty. Un trône sans roi, a throne without a king, is a transitional piece of music on Johnny Hallyday's album. But if you use your imagination, you might see how it would have underscored action had the rock opera ever been staged. It is a place where the mousetrap would be, and through the repetition of the dirge motif, Le Vieux Roi est mort, the old king is dead, which Hallyday already used twice before, it has a similar recap function. It is telling that the chorus sings here and not Hamlet, though as we know from the play, he's written their words. This is the murder as presented by the players. We could well imagine the processional music underscoring the arrival of the court to the playhouse. Then, suspenseful strings over the dumb show, probably dance-like. Thank you. And finally, we end with the result of a king's death and the familiar Dead Old King theme. The first two lines are the same, but reiterate, as Hamlet does in the text, the temporal collapse caused by his grief. Using the chorus as the players transfers that collapse to the people, foreshadowing their later rebellion. In fact, the lines here go further, from less than a month in the earlier song to now the span of a church service in this one. The king has been forgotten by the time his funeral service is over. And then time has collapsed even further, when a new king shows up in the next line. So Hamlet Sr. has been forgotten in the breath between two lines. Those final lines do play on an ambiguity, as the king is actually two separate characters in the play. The lines go, and forgive my doggerel translation, "He is our king, he sinks his ass in." On the one hand, we have the people embracing the dead king as theirs, but also mocking his burial. On the other, they accept a new king and mock his sitting on the throne. That is the story of the Mousetrap, even if the play within a play isn't strictly evoked here. All right, that ends our look at Act 3, Scene 2, Part 2. Next week, we move right along to reactions to the play. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com, leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope, dear listener, you'll return for Act 3, Scene 2, Part 3, Critical Receptions.
The rest is silence.